Hello, listeners, as we begin the first of a three-part series with Seth Klein. I'd like to welcome Seth Klein to Radio Free Thinkers Virtual Studio. Seth Klein is director of Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives here in BC. He has graciously agreed to share his knowledge and opinion on a number of policy issues, such as austerity, taxation, and inequality in BC, Canada, and abroad. This week, we're going to focus on austerity policy. Hello and welcome, Mr. Klein.
Hi.
Recently, there have been a number of elections in Europe, notably France electing its first, quote, socialist president in a long time. The Greeks also voting no to austerity by voting for radical left and right parties. Austerity programs have been implemented in the UK, Ireland, Spain, and Greece. It's kind of become the flavor of the day for governments. To you, what exactly is austerity measures?
Well, austerity is any time that governments are substantially cutting spending, purportedly because, you know, they claim they have no choice in order to bring budget deficits down. And so they are reducing the role of government within an economy, within a society. I would actually add to your list there that local elections recently in Greece also were a clear vote against the austerity of Angela Merkel. So across Europe, we're seeing a real pushback now where people are saying, we don't agree that there's no choice. We don't agree with this level of government cutbacks. And we don't think that the public at large, and in particular lower income people who rely on government programs, should be paying the price for a financial mess that wasn't of their making.
You say wasn't of their making. So the austerity measures are sort of intended to fix a problem. What was the problem?
Well, I mean, there are some substantial deficits in some of these countries, not much in others. There's a lot of variety. But the line that you get is, you know, these are societies that were just living beyond their means and where people felt some outrageous sense of entitlement in terms of the benefits that they derive. But in fact, and this was true in the Canadian story back in the 1990s, where we were told the same stuff before Paul Martin began some very dramatic austerity cuts in the 1990s, which was that, you know, we were living high on the hog and spending on our credit cards, and we had to be pulled back. In fact, when you looked at what was behind those deficits, a big chunk of it is a tax story, that the revenues aren't coming in the way that they should because of tax cuts that have disproportionately benefited corporations or upper income earners. Or it could be because of, well, in our case in the 90s, high interest rates. Or it could be that governments, in the case of Greece, you know, were involved in loan arrangements with foreign banks and paying interest rates that were usurious.
So austerity is happening in Europe, but what about, you know, the Harper government? You mentioned Paul Martin in the 90s, but I mean, is it happening, you know, in Canada? Is it happening in BC? You released a recent report about taxation, the BC government. Are austerity measures being enacted or experienced here in Canada, BC, and Vancouver?
Well, certainly not like they're happening in Europe. I mean, and in particular in Greece, where the social costs of what's happening are horrific, frankly. I mean, the suicide rate alone in Greece as a consequence of some of this is deeply disturbing. In the case of the Canadian context, I think it's a more complicated picture. I would say that what we have right now from the Harper government is an austerity government. Is an austerity budget, not to the same extent as Paul Martin. The cuts under Paul Martin were actually worse. In the case of the Harper government, overall government spending is continuing to increase because transfers to the provinces and to individuals are continuing to increase modestly. But when you look at the federal public service itself, the things that the federal government spends money on itself, we're looking at huge cuts now. So the direct public service is going to be cut by 12,000 jobs. But if you included crown corporations like the CBC, it's going to be much worse. If you include cuts to government contracts and a ripple effect through the private sector, we are going to be looking at tens of thousands of job losses. And that will have an economic impact that's going to feel an awful lot like austerity.
That's always been one of the things that's always kind of bugged me in a way with the way that kind of government works, is people sort of complain about, well, why are we paying for these services? They don't seem to be, you know, they're not there. I have to wait so long for my driver's license or something like that. So then they cut back more money to these services, which just makes the wait even longer. And it's almost like that spiral down.
Yeah, and we are going to see that federally and provincially, where wait for things from the federal government are certainly going to increase with the kind of staffing cuts that they're looking at. By the way, you were asking earlier about the BC situation. I would say that we don't have an austerity fiscal situation in British Columbia. Overall spending is going up, but that spending has been concentrated in a few areas where they haven't cut, health and education in particular. Although, and even in the case of education and health, they're not spending a pace with what population needs are and inflation and that kind of thing. So even though overall spending may be going up, in other areas, particularly in environment, we are seeing big cuts.
So you kind of mentioned before that ostensibly austerity measures are intended sort of to reduce government debt. Does it work that way? I mean, is the real problem just governments are spending more than they have?
Well, austerity, first of all, we need to differentiate between debt and deficit. So the austerity programs tend to come in when governments have deficits, as there is in most countries right now in the wake of the downturn and the recession in 2008, when we saw these substantial increases in deficits. And for the most part, that was appropriate. You see, for the most part, you would expect, you know, governments to have deficits when they hit economic hard times. And that's not a problem. In economic terms, we're much more interested, in terms of the economic health of a society, we're much more interested in debt, not deficit. Meaning, you know, if you put this in household terms, we're not really concerned about where people are at in any given year if they're spending more than they're taking in. What we really want to know is what's their overall accumulated household debt, and is it manageable? Meaning, what's the size of that debt relative to their income? And the same is true for a society. Like, as economists, what we're particularly interested in is what's the debt to GDP ratio? Meaning, what's the size of the overall debt relative to that society's income? And in both the BC and the Canadian context, it's just fine, thank you. We are not in a serious debt situation. So you might cut spending in order to cut your deficit, but you might harm the economy if you do that, and your debt to GDP ratio might actually suffer as a consequence.
One of the things with the debt to GDP, from what I've done reading and writing, that sort of thing, Japan has one of the worst of these ratios, right? I mean, debt is so much higher than its GDP. I think it's approaching 200%. But the Japanese economy doesn't seem to be in the same free fall that you're getting in Greece. I mean, Canada may be in somewhat good shape, but how does that play out in the global market in general?
Well, first of all, the Canadian debt to GDP ratio is only about 35%. And really, that's why I say it's not a concern. We're in a situation where, you know, if and when we feel like we need to run deficits for a time, we can and should feel like we can do that. And there is a real risk, and I think this is what we're seeing in Greece right now. You know, and so Greece does have a high debt to GDP ratio. There's no doubt about that. But if your response is austerity and cutbacks, and consequently you further pile on and send the economy into a tailspin, then you're only going to make matters worse. You know, it's the old adage that you can't cut your way back to a healthy economy. When an economy is struggling, as the Greek economy currently is, and as a consequence, individuals don't have money to spend, and the private sector is nervous and not spending, then the government sector is the only game in town. And if it too decides to cut its spending, as is now happening, then you just go into a tailspin.
One of the things, actually, I've never quite been able to figure out, as part of the austerity measures of Greece, was the reduction of the minimum wage. Now, the other things about cutting services and all that, I could say, well, maybe, you know, I don't agree with that method, but I could see that you're reducing actual government spending. But how does reducing the minimum wage somehow reduce the debt?
Well, that's a really good question. And I think what we're actually seeing the Europeans and at the will of the banks who hold the Greek loans imposing on Greece is very similar to the old, you know, what we used to what we used to decry when the IMF used to impose a similar policy package on Latin American and African countries, which is structural adjustment. And a structural adjustment package generally, you know, takes the form of cuts in spending by government, but it also includes a whole bunch of other measures that are about making purportedly making the economy open for private sector investment, which is a euphemistic way of saying cut regulations, cut wages, and make it an investor's paradise to attract back all of this private capital. First of all, it's unlikely to happen when an economy is in as rough shape as that. And secondly, to the extent that it does, it's a massive transfer of income and wealth to people. It's taking advantage of a situation to the benefit of some and where the majority is paying the price.
Sort of like Naomi Klein's shock doctrine.
It is the shock doctrine thesis.
You mentioned, you know, trying to promote the economy. Currently, the Harper government and provincial governments are attempting to reduce regulations on the assumption that regulations somehow slow economic growth. I mean, this may be why the prime minister has decided to gut essentially the environmental laws in the current budget. What truth is there to this role of regulations and a sound economy?
Very little, I would say. Often you'll get people painting regulations with some broad brush, but arguably there are many kinds of regulations that provide a form of stability that actually encourages investment. In the case of what the Harper government's doing right now, I think, let's be clear, they're particularly targeting the environmental regulatory regime because their economic development strategy is all about the energy industry and oil and gas and trying to expedite its extraction and export. And so it's about clearing whatever regulatory hurdles are standing in the way of that happening.
I find it quite interesting that they've raised, you know, sort of foreigners interfering in our political system, and one make reference to money laundering and sort of pseudo-terrorism. And yet we rarely hear them complain about the money that, quote, big oil has put in towards its lobbying efforts and all that. I remember Ethical Oil, which was a website, I'm sure if you're acquainted with it, which was essentially a front for tar sands industry. You know, it's very selective onto what is good and what is bad. But I mean, I guess it just belies their ideological background.
Yeah. Well, and not only that foreign money that's funding the lobbying, but the tar sands themselves is populated in the majority by foreign-owned firms.
I thought it was quite funny with the election they just had in Alberta. I mean, Alberta, which is quite often painted as the 51st American state, I mean, they are more American than many Americans are. And they're voting between the traditional right-wing Banana Republic Party and the even more ultra-right-wing Wild Rose Party. And it just struck me as funny.
It is, although, you know, there was something interesting in play in Alberta. I mean, it remains to be seen exactly what kind of a leader Alison Redford is. But she's certainly within that kind of broad conservative tent that is the Alberta Progressive Conservative Party. She kind of comes from the mold of the Peter Lougheed mold. Back in the day when he was the premier of Alberta, I'm sure most of us would have considered him pretty conservative. But we look back at that now, and here was somebody who was very cautious in the development of the tar sands, who had high royalty rates on the oil industry, who took billions of dollars of that income and put it into a long-term heritage fund for Albertans in the same way that Norway does, and which Albertans are still benefiting from. But there isn't a single conservative premier since Lougheed who've added to that heritage fund, even as the industry was exploding.
Well, that's one of the sort of changes of quote-unquote conservatism in the Western world, really, is from that sort of resistance to change, do things slowly, to essentially being more of a corporate puppetist. I mean, there is so much talk about, you know, we need to cut back welfare, but the idea of corporate welfare seems to go on quite strongly. And it's this, I don't know, as you say, it seems to be a shift in what conservatism even means.
Yeah, you know, we had Bill McKibben in town a couple of months ago from 350.org. And he has a nice way of putting it. He's organized this mass civil disobedience last summer in Washington over the Keystone XL pipeline and other activities around the world. You know, he says when you're coming to one of these protests, wear your Sunday best. We're the conservatives. And the people like Stephen Harper, who are prepared to play havoc with the ecosystem and the atmosphere without any appreciation of what the consequences might be, they're the radicals.
That's one of the aspects of regulation, is the whole idea that the externalities. I mean, you either pay now or you pay later. And often the pay later is society paying for things like cleanup costs or what have you. Whereas now you should be putting money aside, the corporation should be, when they do these sort of events.
That's right. Well, and that plays out in so many ways on so many issues. But often with regulation, we're just trying to ensure that society as a whole isn't paying for the health or environmental or safety consequences of the investment choices of industry.
Well, this sort of leads me into my next question then. We hear so much talk about how important it is to ensure that we have a healthy economy, that we need to sort of restructure society to ensure a strong economy. To me, that's always kind of seemed backwards, that we should be really trying to restructure the economy to ensure a strong society. Am I wrong on this?
No, you're right. Yeah, the economy is a construct, and it's there to serve people and not the other way around.
But it seems that we have now, we've reversed that. I mean, whenever you hear politicians talk about, we need to sacrifice, we need to suffer ourselves to ensure the economy is doing well, and that...
Well, part of it, I think, is, and this is why, you know, the CCPA came into its own in the 1990s, arguing against the original free trade deal with the United States. And ever since, we've argued against different forms of corporate globalization, which over time shift the bargaining relationship, really, between a society and for-profit capital investment, where because those corporations are so mobile now, they are able to issue threats with more credibility to say, things have to be our way or we're leaving. There's a lot of bluffing that goes on in that regard, but there's also some truth. It's not for no reason that we argued as we did against these kinds of agreements. But I think what's also at the root of politicians saying what you just said, they say, and rightly so, is we too often, and it's not just politicians, in some ways it's the public at large, we become resigned to this notion that only the private sector and only the for-profit private sector engages in investment and job creation. And the second you accept that premise, you have to accept a whole bunch of other propositions with it, namely that we have to organize our economy and our wages and our regulatory regime and our tax regime in a way that keeps those corporations satisfied and sticking around. I think we would be much better off if we take a broader conception and say, you know what? They don't have a monopoly on investment and job creation. That happens anytime we combine human ingenuity and capital finances and natural resources to add value to something and create something of value. And sometimes the for-profit sector does that. Sometimes it does it badly. And sometimes we do that through our communities, through our governments, through our crown corporations, through our credit unions and co-ops. First Nations can do it. We need to change our bargaining relationship and feel confident that there are many options before us.
I find it quite interesting that a lot of the quote-unquote economic reforms has been made it easier for capital money to flow between borders, to make essentially a borderless society for money. And yet at the same time, there seems to be increasing difficulty for actual people, for labor, to move to one zone or another. And you have this sort of disparity of freedom. And I think that leads a lot into it. What can we do to sort of reverse this sort of relationship?
Yeah, well, you're pointing to an interesting paradox. I mean, you do get some neoliberal thinkers who at least are consistent, you know, who believe in capital mobility, but who also believe in free labor mobility. But they're kind of few and far between. More often you get neoliberal practitioners with a real double standard, which is, you know, mobility for capital, but labor not so much. I mean, I think a huge issue in terms of that bargaining relationship in Canada right now is this explosion in temporary foreign workers, which the Harper government has been expanding even further and now allowing employers to reduce their wages by 15%. You know, we need immigration as a society, but historically, immigrants came and were immediately entitled to the same rights as anybody else. And when you had labor mobile that way, it could allow for the gradual improvement in standards. But when labor, even when mobile, is restricted, when they don't have access to real rights, if they exercise their rights and they're rewarded with a ticket home, that puts downward pressure on wages, and it means that the gains of economic growth go much more narrowly towards capital and those at the top.
So thank you for your insight and your information regarding austerity. Is there any parting message you would like to send to our audience?
Oh, I guess when it comes to the BC and Canadian context, just that there's absolutely no economic rationale for austerity. We're in a perfectly healthy fiscal situation. We can afford to take better care of one another and to protect the environment. And indeed, I'd say collectively, we can well afford to pay more in taxes to all ante into the collective kitty and meet more of our needs that way.
And if people want to find out more about the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, they can get in touch how?
The website is just policyalternatives.ca, or the BC blog is just policynote.ca.
Thank you again for your time. Tune in next week, the second part of my talk with Seth, where we discuss taxes and taxation policy.